Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Okay, so I'm very grateful that Damien Freeman, who's about to go back to Britain, has found time to come here tonight, so we had to put it on this Holy of Holy Nights because we had no other days. Now, Damien Freeman studied law, philosophy, and classical Hebrew and Aramaic at the University of Sydney and at Magdalen College, Cambridge. In 2011, he published Arts, Emotions, Ethics, Expression, and Aesthetic Experience, and he's also published in the Australian Bar Review, the Public Law Review, the Constitutional Law and Policy Review, the Harvard Review of Philosophy, and the Journal of Aesthetic Education and Literature, and he currently teaches ethics and aesthetics at Pembroke College in Cambridge. For one so young, he's achieved an awful lot, but including the publication of Roddy's Folly, R.P. Maher QC, Art Lover and Lawyer, which has recently come out. And tonight, Damien Freeman's going to talk to us on the topic Larger Than Life, Roddy Maher QC. You're very welcome, Damien.
Ladies and gentlemen, when Dr. Henderson kindly extended an invitation to speak to you today, he proposed that my topic should be Larger Than Life, Roddy Maher QC. What, you might ask, is the connection between Larger Than Life and Roddy Maher QC? Having completed a biography of Roddy Maher, I too was intrigued by what Dr. Henderson had in mind. Perhaps he took his lead from Tony Abbott in launching Roddy's Folly, my biography of R.P. Maher QC. Mr. Abbott quoted from my subject's list of nice things and nasty things that have vanished in my lifetime, and summed up the man. In short, he liked everything that was larger than life. This is to suggest that what was larger than life were the things that appealed to Maher, rather than the man himself. Of course, his very stature was large, and his personality was even larger than that. Sometimes this larger-than-life personality was referred to as a wonderful character. There is the Financial Review's Roddy the kimono-wearing QC, stretched out on his bed, conducting a conference in his hotel room, and showing a significant amount of leg to his colleagues. There is Art and Australia's Roddy the redhead collector's eccentricities. Not the least of these is his penchant for dyeing his hair, albeit a subtle shade of auburn, and for wearing gem-encrusted rings and strings of beads and necklaces hidden beneath his judicial robes. And there is the Good Weekend's Roddy, blowing kisses to his psychotic Alsatian Didier above the strains of Schubert, who is, we are told, as odd as the dog is mad. In the conclusion to Roddy's Folly, I discuss at length the difference between a character and an eccentric, and suggest that to understand my subject properly is to see past the larger-than-life character and to see him as an eccentric, one who pursues thoughts and actions that seem authentic to him, irrespective of public opinions and reactions. So, if we're to identify what is larger than life with the man, rather than with the things that appeal to him, I'm not inclined to do so on the basis of his physical stature or his larger than life character. Today I should like to explore the possibility that it was the controversies that he involved himself in, indeed often gleefully created, that made him seem larger than life. In short, I should like to examine what made others regard him as a controversial figure. I propose that we consider four controversies in which Maher became embroiled. One, his speech about political correctness in the Great Hall at the University of Sydney when he was awarded an honorary degree. Another, concerning the gift of a painting of a naked lady to the New South Wales Bar Association. and its subsequent removal from the Bar Association's common room. The third, his remarks about women at the bar and Justice Gaudron's response to them. And finally, his various utterances over the years about Aborigines, which have attracted the ire of many, including Pat O'Shane. In the following discussion, I shall seek to demonstrate how each of these might be seen as representing different ill effects of political correctness. Each might also be seen as illustrating something about what is larger than life in the controversial Mr. Maher, or why his vision for society seems to be larger than the reality that he perceives in society. Finally, I shall say something about the different ways in which I believe that he felt that political correctness was eroding the largeness of our collective life. So first, for the speech at the university. On the 19th of May 2000, the Chancellor of the University of Sydney conferred the degree of Doctor of Laws on Mr. Justice Maher. The award was intended to recognise both his contribution to legal scholarship and his devotion to the university. As Fellow of St John's College, tutor at St Paul's College, Fellow of the University's Senate, and most notably, his 30-year career as Chalice Lecturer in Roman Law and the Principles of Equity. Maher was invited to give an address before his fellow graduands and their guests. Recently, I heard that one guest remembered that his speech was disgusting, although she couldn't recall what he actually said. What he said was twofold. First, he said that a lawyer had no business concerning himself with organising marches and rallies, as such activities would distract his attention from his sole responsibility as a legal practitioner, which was to serve the interests of his client. Secondly, he attacked political correctness within the academy, which, he said, prevents individuals from asserting claims which may be true, but which are deemed to be politically incorrect, and therefore unworthy of attention. Professor Chris Kinneen, then at Sydney, sent an email message to all the members of the law school staff afterwards, saying, "Many people found the speech highly offensive. Among other topics, it referred to niggers and advised people that to join the Reconciliation March this Sunday would be bowing to political correctness. I'm appalled that the final message the students I have taught had from this law school was that anti-intellectual bigotry is okay and indeed rewarded." It is unfortunate that the remarks were made days before the People's Walk for Reconciliation across the Harbour Bridge. However, it's obvious from the text that Maher was referring to marches generally and not giving advice about a particular one. To take offence at the reference to niggers was simply being oversensitive. What Maher said was, "Ronald Furbank cannot be reprinted because his most famous novel is called Prancing Nigger." Maher's purpose was not to advocate the use of derogatory language, but to lament a situation in which parts of our cultural heritage cannot be discussed for fear of being branded as politically incorrect. And I assume it's obvious that we might legitimately disagree about the value of Furbank's Prancing Nigger as a novel whilst being able to agree that the use of nigger in contemporary discourse is unacceptable. Some decades earlier, Professor Julius Stone had written a letter to the editor of the Sydney Morning Herald criticising a speech that Maher had given about legal education and training. This involves submitting Maher's argument to rigorous analysis. By the time Professor Kinneen attacked Maher's later speech, rigorous analysis had given way to heated debates, in which Maher was criticised for using an inappropriate term rather than engaging in rigorous analysis of his use of the term to prove why it is inappropriate. It is in this way that political correctness seemed to Maher to distract attention away from the pursuit of knowledge. The second incident that I'll talk about was in the Bar Association common room. One of Maher's most colourful controversies concerned a painting by Geoffrey Proud that he donated, together with a number of colleagues, to the New South Wales Bar Association in 1975. The gift was accepted by the Council of the Bar Association, and the huge picture of the naked lady hung in the bar common room for two decades and was the source of endless debate. Then, in 1994, Murray Tobias QC became the president, and one of his first actions was to have the painting removed from the Bar Association's premises. Murr was furious when he heard of this, and attempted to resign his life membership of the association. In removing the painting, Tobias was attempting to respond to calls for the bar to be seen to be responding to the legitimate concerns of the women in its ranks. The feminists had been arguing for decades that it was inappropriate to hang a picture of a naked woman in a public space within the premises of a professional association. It was all the more offensive to them because most of the other pictures in the common room were formal portraits of men in the ceremonial attire of the leaders of their profession. And the only depiction of a woman was that of a naked one, apparently intended to satisfy the male gaze. For the feminists, it was politically incorrect to hang the painting, and they supported its removal. The campaign to bring the painting back to the common room was mounted by one of the vice presidents, Rick Burbage, QC. Burbage was not interested in the aesthetic value of the painting any more than he was in the political incorrectness of hanging it in the common room. What concerned him was due process and deference for the solemn resolutions of the Bar Council. The council had formally resolved to accept the gift. On several subsequent occasions, attempts were made to remove the painting, and the council repeatedly resolved against such action. From Burbage's point of view, if the president wanted to remove the painting, he had to do so with the express permission of the council, and he failed to obtain the council's approval before removing it in this case. Murr was furious about this politically correct stunt, and he made much of the technical issues concerning the president's lack of authority. However, what really offended him was the fact that the painting was being judged according to some standard other than aesthetic value. For Murr, a work of art should be assessed according to its aesthetic merit alone, not its morality. A painting that is politically incorrect might lack moral value, but lack of moral value is not, in his mind, a proper basis for evaluating a work of art. Thus, for Murr, political correctness had become a threat to beauty as much as to truth. So thirdly, I'd like to talk about the Good Weekend article. In 2002, the Good Weekend ran a profile of Justice Murr, in which he offered his views on a range of topics, including the following remarks. The bar desperately needs more women barristers. There are so many bad ones that people may say that women can't be good barristers and are hopeless by nature. But that is not so. It's a pity the able people don't come. Mary Gaudron, then a justice of the High Court, responded in a speech a month later, and she said, "It is and always has been relatively simple to dismiss such remarks as the mutterings of male malcontents who, for very good reason, fear dealing with women on equal terms. However, the nature and probable consequence of a remark of that kind when made by one of the most senior judges of this state's Court of Appeal is that few, if any, women barristers will be briefed to appear in that court. We should not insult Justice Murr's intelligence by pretending that he did not intend that very consequence." Well, did Murr intend that consequence? I doubt it. I think his remark was nothing more than stirring. If one reads it closely, he does not say that he thinks women cannot be good barristers, but that some people might think this, and that he thinks that it is not true. I think this is an attempt to tease the feminists and to ruffle their feathers. This he succeeded in doing. It is true that he probably thought that a lot of women barristers were bad ones, but this must be seen in the context that he probably thought most people at the bar were hopeless. Murr was one of the most successful barristers of his generation. He belonged to the elite of the elite and probably thought that there were no more than a dozen good barristers in Sydney at any one time. Perhaps he did not think there were any women among the top dozen barristers in Sydney. However, that hardly counts as a meaningful reflection on the overall quality of women at the bar, and Murr knew this. As with most of his remarks about women, he was stirring his politically correct enemies. He knew the naughtiness of what he was saying. He knew that it really would not make any difference in the grand scheme of things. He knew that it would irritate the feminists. He knew that they had no sense of humour when it came to such matters. And I think he knew that anyone who understood him properly would know that he was not really hostile to women in any way. And he enjoyed watching the feminists misunderstand the situation and get so worked up about their misunderstanding. For such people, there was no room for Roddy's humour. He despised the fact that political correctness was hostile to his humour, and he reacted against this. Fourthly, I'd like to talk about his remarks concerning Aborigines. There are the remarks about Aborigines that have led some to brand him as a racist. These fall into two categories. First, there was his staunch opposition to affirmative action with respect to judicial appointments. Pat O'Shane told those gathered at the launch of the Alternative Law Review that the Chief Justice of Australia then, Sir Harry Gibbs, described as heresy the view that the courts should be representative of all races, sexes, classes, creeds, and geographical regions, irrespective of the merits of the individuals concerned. She then continued to explain, "Those kinds of expressions are not rare and isolated. In Sydney in recent months, we have become aware of these xenophobic pronouncements of Mr. Justice Maher, of the undesirability of Aborigines entering the legal profession." This and other comments prompted Maher to respond to O'Shane in the following terms. "You said I had expressed a view that no Aborigines should ever be appointed to judicial office. In fact, I have never said anything of the sort, nor do I believe anything of the sort. I have said and still believe a person should not be appointed a judge merely because he or she is an Aborigine. To make a token appointment would be insulting to the appointee, to the judicial office in question, and to the Aboriginal race as a whole. That is a very different matter." In resisting the idea that people should be appointed to judicial office for reasons other than merit, Maher was undoubtedly correct. That is not to say, however, that there is no reason for concern when only a narrow section of the community possesses the requisite merit. More problematic is his persistent use of the word abo. It was a word that was in common parlance in his youth and perhaps was then uttered without any malice. He persisted in using this language as a challenge to political correctness. He was determined that no one would tell him which words he could and could not use to express himself. It is worth remembering that the word abo, although unacceptable and universally regarded as offensive today, is not in its origin offensive in the way that a word such as bung has always had an offensive and derogatory sense. For Ma, bung is offensive, abo is merely politically incorrect. It is one thing to avoid offensive language, it is another to refrain from using language on the grounds of political incorrectness. I think, however, that we can probably all agree that abo is not merely politically correct, but also offensive. However, for the sake of telling you one story that I found insightful, let us accept that Maher maintained a distinction between offensive and politically incorrect language, and that whereas bung was offensive to him, abo was merely politically incorrect. I was talking to him about some paintings that I'd been looking at by Albert Namajira, and why I thought they were superior to paintings in the same style by other Aboriginal artists. Maher said to me, "I've never liked Namajira's paintings. They lack any expression of abo's spirituality." For Maher, Namajira was simply imitating what French painters had been doing a century earlier. He was suspicious of a lot of Aboriginal art for many years. This was, no doubt, in part because it was trendy. Then he went to the Northern Territory and walked around Uluru, or Ayers Rock. I'm not sure which name he would have used. Then he became enamoured of Aboriginal art and collected several important works. It was in this way that he came to appreciate that there was something that counted as Abbo spirituality, which was valuable and which could find expression in art. Aboriginal art that expresses Abbo spirituality is then valuable, more valuable as Aboriginal art than art that does not express it, and Namajira's work is overrated if it fails this test, as Ma believed that it did. Well, you might think this is all very nice, but it doesn't really require the use of denigrating language to make the point. Perhaps that Ma could have made the same point by referring to Aboriginal spirituality. Perhaps he could have. But I think he was getting at something deeper. I think that he believed that deference to political correctness would do nothing to cultivate Aboriginal spirituality or the wider appreciation of this in the general community. I think that he believed that political correctness prevented us from getting closer to understanding the meaningfulness and authenticity of Aboriginal experience. Perhaps he was wrong about that, but I think he believed that, and it was for this reason that Abbo's spirituality seemed important to me. In his own controversial way, he was making a significant point. Well, what are we to make of these four examples? In particular, should we make sense of these examples in the same way or in different ways? I think that in each of these examples, we see a pervasive concern with political correctness, and yet in each we see different ways in which political correctness worries him. In his speech at the Great Hall, Ma directly attacked political correctness. In this case, he was concerned with the effect that it was having on freedom of thought within the academy. Rightly or wrongly, he maintained that political correctness curtailed independent thought by stipulating which ideas were unacceptable for reasons other than having been proved false. Ma is not defending vilification in controversies such as this one. Rather, he is asserting that freedom of thought is no less important than freedom from vilification. In this example, political correctness comes in conflict with the quest for truth. In the saga at the Bar Association and Jeffrey Proud's painting, Ma was reacting against what he saw as the president's capitulation to political correctness. When he authorised the removal of the painting of the naked lady out of deference to the concerns of female members of the Bar Association, this action might be seen as outrageous for a number of reasons. The reason that I've suggested that most offended Ma was that the correct way to judge a painting is in terms of its aesthetic merits. Morality has no relevance for aesthetic value, and so the diktats of political correctness, whatever their moral status, have no relevance for aesthetic evaluation. Therefore, they did not provide a basis for removing an otherwise aesthetically valuable work of art. In this example, political correctness comes in conflict with beauty. The comments about women, such as those made in The Good Weekend, are also to be understood as an attack on political correctness and its advocates. Here, however, the concern is nothing so lofty as truth or beauty. In this, Roddy was being naughty and enjoying the way he so deftly enrages the politically correct through remarks that deliberately mask his genuine thoughts. Political correctness seems dull to him. It detracts from the lustre of life. It takes itself too seriously and is unnecessarily hostile to good humour. The difficulty that many find with this criticism of the earnestness of political correctness is that the alienation of those in the margins of society is no laughing matter. It needs to be addressed, and it can only be addressed by taking it seriously. Roddy was capable of addressing serious issues, but he saw no reason to exile humour from serious discussion. In this example, political correctness comes in conflict with the perhaps idiosyncratic value that Ma places on humour. Finally, there are the remarks about Aborigines, which have led some to think that he was racist. I've concentrated on one private conversation in which he told me about Abbo's spirituality. I can well understand why some people might believe that those insights could have been expressed equally well in language that was neither intentionally nor inadvertently denigrating. I've tried to draw out the sense, however, in which there was some deeper significance attached to his use of politically incorrect language in this context. It might seem like a tenuous example. I can only say that it struck me that there was something more to this, as so often his command of language provided the facade which masked the true attitude to his subject. In this example, political correctness comes in conflict with the expression of spirituality. I've chosen these examples not because they are necessarily the most important or insightful, but because they were sensational. So they help us to understand the controversy that he attracted. They also show the variety of ways in which the phenomenon that we might call political correctness offended him. Always he seems to be stirring and pushing the envelope of acceptability. Always he recruits humour as the most powerful weapon in his arsenal when attacking political correctness. Always he seems to be concerned with some deeper truth that his opponents failed to grasp. Whether or not he succeeded in exposing the shortcomings of political correctness, always he seems to have succeeded in attracting controversy. This he loved in equal measure as he despised the pernicious effects of political correctness. So, how are we to understand the relationship between Roddy Marr and larger than life? Often, he did seem larger than the world he inhabited. Her Excellency, the Governor of New South Wales, admitted as much when she said, "In fact, let's face it, we need more people like Roddy. We're becoming a bit bland in our affluent society, aren't we?" Much of the largeness of Roddy's life can be seen in the colourful way that he railed against public acceptance of political correctness. For Marr, political correctness seemed to pose a threat to humour in public life as much as it did to the appreciation of beauty, truth and spirituality in that realm. The former Chief Justice of Australia, Murray Gleeson, observes, "Roddy Marr had a strong belief in what G.K. Chesterton called the romance of orthodoxy. Heresy, he considered, is dull. When he thought heretics were being ridiculous, he ridiculed them remorselessly and sometimes extravagantly. The present is not a good age for orthodoxy, but he had notable successes, including some that have come to be acknowledged by those committed to the promotion of change." The former Prime Minister, John Howard, notes that this was not only effective, but also appealing for those who shared his sympathies. He says, "He had a capacity to talk in a colourful and therefore attention-attracting fashion about his conservative beliefs. He made it interesting to be a conservative." Recently, I heard the Sydney Symphony Orchestra perform Mozart's Requiem. In the programme notes, in the introduction, it says, "In his funeral prayer, Mozart was perfectly equipped to portray fear, trust, sorrow, optimism and hope, the emotions that touch the souls of the faithful in the face of death." The performance left a slightly different impression on me. It seemed to me that Mozart was presenting us not with an actual experience of emotion, but with a possible experience. What interested me was the sense in which it was possible that you could experience fear, trust, optimism and hope in a particular way. It's the idea that there was a special way of experiencing it that was important about the Requiem. In The Principles of Art, R.G. Collingwood explains that we can experience emotions in more or less precise ways, and that the role of the artist is to offer us a very precise experience of emotion, one that enables us to comprehend the emotion rather than have the sort of vague and imprecise feelings that we encounter in our everyday life. This special way of experiencing emotion is what I think is certainly what Collingwood thought was unique about art. When I listened to Mozart's Requiem, it was as if I had become exposed to a human possibility that I did not encounter in the world that I inhabit. It affirmed for me the possibility of experiencing fear, trust, sorrow, optimism, and hope in a more precise, pure, authentic way than seems to be possible in the world that I inhabit. Roddy Marr was, I believe, acutely aware of what it would mean to engage with truth, beauty, and spirituality in a precise, pure, and authentic way. He was acutely aware of just how short of the mark our society is in terms of the way in which it engages with the true, the beautiful, and the spiritual. Truly, his experience of the true, the beautiful, and the spiritual seems to have been larger than life, at least larger than the experience of these that is articulated in our public discourse. Rightly or wrongly, he perceived political correctness to be responsible for this malady in society. No doubt political correctness has made some valuable contributions to society. Perhaps these contributions were lost on Marr. Probably they were. What was not lost on him was the damage that he perceived it was wreaking. To the extent that he is correct in maintaining that political correctness can have a negative effect on society, it behoves us to strive to find a way of balancing the benefits of political correctness with the need to avert the worst of its deleterious effects. The things that were larger than life appealed to Roddy Marr. He inhabited a world that increasingly seemed bereft of the large possibilities that he saw for it. Much of what made him seem larger than life was his acute awareness of the smallness of the world he inhabited. Whether or not one agrees with his analysis of the causes of the diminishing scale of life, it is undoubtedly to his credit that he resisted it in the way that seemed best to him. He would not go gentle into that good night. He raged and raged, the dying of the light.
Many thanks. Janet Grundy's got some copies of Roddy's Folly, R.P. Marr QC, Art Lover and Lawyer, and I'm sure Damien would be happy to sign them before he goes back to Cambridge on Friday. So we come to questions and discussion. The last time I recall meeting Roddy Marr, I didn't know him well, was in this room, actually, I suspect in 1989, probably just before he went on the Court of Appeal. You presented a man in a very captivating portrait of a man, but towards the end you talk about his love of the sensational and his commitment to controversy, and the question, I guess, if he were merely a barrister, I mean, that would be understandable, but for most of his controversies and most of his sensational comments, he was a judge, a senior judge of the Supreme Court. Now, I know that Michael Kirby was into a bit of this, and so was Mary Gaudron, but are these the kind of comments that a senior judge should have been making, or are these the kind of comments that a senior barrister should have been making?
Yeah, I think it's right to distinguish there between his time at the bar and on the bench. One preliminary comment that I'll make concerns the assessment of his career as a barrister and as a judge. You'll see in the book, when it comes to his career at the bar, everyone largely thought that he was a success. I mean, he was very widely regarded as a successful barrister. When you look at his career on the bench, you see a much wider range of views as to whether he was a good judge or not. And so I introduce that first of all because I think it would be fair to say he was a more successful QC than he was judge. I think really he was in his element when he was at the bar. And it's for that reason that I put on the cover R.P. Marr QC, because I think that's where he was really most successful. So it's right to distinguish those two things. Your point is not about his professional career, but the fact that he was making the remarks. I think there is a difference between making the remarks as a barrister and as a judge. In the one case, he was senior, but he was in a private capacity. In the other case, he had an official office. He was odd, it has to be said, on this point about whether judges should speak publicly or not, because he would criticise Michael Kirby for speaking publicly, and he would say, no, you're not meant to speak publicly if you're a judge, and it's very bad that Michael Kirby does this. And yet it was remarked by Gerald Cripps that he somehow managed to get away with saying a lot more, as you say, than anyone else. And so there was, I think, a deep inconsistency in him on this point, that he thought he wasn't prepared to acknowledge that he was doing what he was saying Michael Kirby shouldn't be doing, and that there was an inconsistency there. How serious it is, I think a lot of the remarks were probably silly more than serious. One thing I'll say on that point was what David Handley, now Director of Sculpture by the Sea, said to me. He had been a lawyer and he'd met Ma in that capacity, and then he asked Ma to be the chairman of Sculpture by the Sea. And he felt that some of this ridiculousness wasn't a bad thing at all. He seemed to think, well, this has made people understand the nature of judges and see that they're real people, and that it sort of it dispelled something of the aura that had previously been around judges. That surprised me to hear that. That's one point. I take the point, though, that there's obviously a position that it was inappropriate for him to be saying some of these things, particularly on the bench. I think the most embarrassing things are when he said in his judgments these really insulting things, that there he wasn't doing the right thing by his judicial office. And the most I can say, I think that there was a real inconsistency in him, that he seemed not to be able to see the fact that he thought he shouldn't do it and yet he was doing it.
Debbie, just stay there. Just say where you are, yeah? And just talk to the back of the room again. Yes, Anne.
Taking that point of inconsistency up, when I looked at the list of his likes and dislikes that Tony Abbott put into his speech, I mean, he doesn't have any philosophical base for his attacks. He doesn't have any kind of creed. He's more like a little bit of an Oscar Wilde character out of another century. And giving that nude to the Bar Association was obviously deliberately provocative. It wasn't an act of aesthetic rejoicing or whatever. It was a deliberate attempt to stir the hornet's nest. And to what extent did he do it? Simply just to have a bit of fun at other people's expense?
Oh, yeah. Look, I think he was definitely... He was doing it to have fun. I mean, he knew it was naughty. I don't think there's any doubt about that. But I think the question is, would he buy a painting that he thought was rubbish and present it to the Bar Association just to stir them?
I'm not saying the painting was rubbish. I'm saying there are many wonderful, beautiful works of art.
Yeah.
Why did he choose something that was deliberately provocative?
Oh, yeah.
It's
yeah.
a context as well as art. And you can an awful lot of art.
Yeah, I agree. If he were thinking, what would be, I'd like to give something to the Bar Association to fill up that big empty wall, what would be a good thing to donate? He donated a drawing or a painting of Sinninian and Lady Stephen. I mean, that's an example, I think, of something that was, he was saying, well, that's an appropriate thing to give. It makes sense. Now, this, clearly he was stirring. And the story is that he had a long lunch and he waddled out of the restaurant and into the gallery and saw this, and that was what triggered it. And look, I do think I think quite clearly this story is a power struggle between him and Janet Coombs. I mean, there's that level of it too, that there really is a level that she'd been trying to get rid of that painting the whole time, and if the president got rid of it, she won, and her prominence within the organisation was rising and his was diminishing, and there's certainly that level of a power game going on.
We know why barristers' fees are so expensive.
My art.
This subject of the controversial painting came up at a lunch that I was at just this week. And I understand it was settled when a female barrister arrived with a painting of a nude male.
Well, that's right. Janet Coombs, well, it wasn't settled by that. What happened? So he presented that...
Just repeat for those who
Yeah. So what happened? He presented... Roddy presents this huge picture of a nude woman. So then Janet Coombs, who was the principal antagonist, she said, well, I don't think this is appropriate, but either you get rid of it, or here, I'm donating to you this picture of a naked man, and you can put that up next to it. So you can either put this up next to it and have both, or you get rid of it, you don't have any. Anyhow, the bar is, it didn't really resolve anything, because the bar council had resolved to accept the first painting, then she donated this one, or attempted to donate it, and the bar council refused to accept it. They said it was too on aesthetic grounds. Firstly, on aesthetic grounds, and secondly, because they were not, in fact, sure that it was a painting of a man.
And they didn't even go and give a fair
parliament. However, that was a stunt on her part, because it was a painting by her mother. Her mother had done it in art class. So, you know, to say that it was... And so their rejecting it on aesthetic grounds was perhaps justified, because the one was by a distinguished painter, the other was by an art student. But that she then kept it in her chambers, and she says that apparently people were very interested in it, and all the women were fascinated by it, and all the men were deeply embarrassed by it. And so it went on, but it certainly didn't resolve it, because it was another 20 years before it disappeared.
Okay, so there's a question here. Yeah, that's right. Go on, speak up.
Mr. Freeman, you've mentioned that he was a conservative and also made certain remarks which is not political correct on Aboriginals. I just have a two-part question. Firstly, was he involved with conservative issues, for example, being tough on crime or things like that? For example, he would be not use the insanity defence, or he wouldn't allow inadmissible evidence by police, and
okay.
So forth.
Yep.
And my second part is that for the Aboriginal, did he come across any Aboriginal criminals in his judgment? For example, he might use stricter law in such that he would say, okay, you are responsible for your own misdeed, and it is not the society.
Yeah. Okay, yeah. So the question, the first one was, was he conservative? And secondly, well, I guess he was on the Court of Appeal anyway, but did he show any particular attitudes in relation to Aboriginals appearing before him?
I mean, well, to answer the second bit first, I don't think there's any significant... I certainly didn't come across any significant cases where he was dealing with Aborigines. I mean, he was in the Court of Appeal. He occasionally sat in the Court of Criminal Appeal, but that meant most of his matters were dealing with civil law, not criminal law. On the occasions when he sat in the Court of Criminal Appeal, he made a number of judgments that were colourful and got into the papers. He was conservative there. Murray Gleeson said he showed himself to be consistent with community values in these matters. He certainly believed in tough sentences. There was one case where some criminal was appealing that this sentence was too long, and that he should have had a shorter sentence. And he said, on the contrary, you know, if anything, it should have been a longer sentence. And he was very clear about these things, about the need to maintain standards in society. There's one case that I talk about, though, which is interesting on the use of language. There was a question whether using the word fuck was offensive or not. And anyhow, this occurred in a police station, and the policeman had been... said he'd come to trial that he'd been accused of using offensive language. And anyhow, Roddy was the only judge on the Court of Criminal Appeal who was prepared to tackle the matter. And he said, no, you know, in a post-Chatterley, post-Wolfensohn society, you know, how can you think that this is offensive in a police station? So I just say that because he could be very conservative and maintain the status quo and say, no, we can't, we have to resist changes in society. But there was a case where he saw this is just silly not to admit that the use of language has changed and it can't be thought to be offensive. So he showed some liberal tendencies at times, but on the whole he was pretty conservative in the Court of Criminal Appeal.
Right, so whilst we're pausing, tell us about your own relationship with him, because you taught him Hebrew. I don't know why he wanted to learn it at his age, but and then in your introduction you've got an introduction in Latin, which seems to be a kind of a Roddy Marish thing to do. Or perhaps it's Aramaic, I mean, I don't know. So, I mean, obviously you're very good at languages, but what you got to know Roddy through these language courses?
Yes, well, I was actually working for Justice Handley, and he went away. He was a judge of the Court of Appeal in Fiji, and he went for a long case to determine the constitutional status of the coup in Fiji, which unsurprisingly turned out to be unconstitutional, and the government simply ignored the Court of Appeal judgment. But anyhow, they went, they had a very long hearing and all of this, and so while he was away, I was asked to work for Justice Ma, because his tip staff was away. And anyhow, I was serving him his tea, and he showed me a book very proudly that had just arrived on German runes. And he said, "When was the last time you saw any German runes?" And I said, "Oh, the last time was graffiti on a wall in Fisher's Stack when I was there for a Hebrew tutorial." "Oh," he said, "you know Hebrew?" "Yes," I said. He said, "Oh, well, you know, I'm in need of a Hebrew teacher." So I said, "Well, Judge, I'd be delighted to teach you." And so then after court each day, we'd have a Hebrew lesson, and he learned the alphabet, and then we started reading the Book of Judges, which I thought would be an appropriate place to start, and off we went. So that was how we became friends, and the context in which this book emerged.
Did you get beyond the alphabet?
Oh, we were translating verses. I mean, he was very good at the grammar, because he'd done Greek and Latin at school and at uni and got first class honours in Greek. And I write quite a bit about his honours thesis in Greek, because he clearly had a very skilled eye when it came to Greek pottery. Really, it was more in archaeology than in Greek. He was very learned, it was very sophisticated what he'd done. But his, you know, because he had this great love of grammar, he was very interested to learn Hebrew grammar and then go through and analyse all the forms of the words and translate the sentences. So we did a bit, yeah.
Janet?
I'm interested to see there are so many drawings by Michael Kirby dotted through the book. Have you a story about how you came to...
Those up the back, it's a question about the drawings by Michael Kirby in the book.
The book contains 16 sketches by Michael Kirby. Well, this was part of the thing when he and Roddy sat in court together, because he always sat, there were always three judges sitting, almost always, when he would sit, because he was on the Court of Appeal. So sometimes he would be with the President, Justice Kirby, and Kirby, all the judges would pass notes to one another, you know, if they needed to clarify something. Kirby liked to draw little sketches whilst he was sitting on the bench. And a number of those, he passed them to Roddy, and then Roddy would leave them there. And anyhow, they were collected up by his staff, which is how I got them. But they tell an interesting story about the relationship between Roddy Marr and Michael Kirby. And you can hear more about that at 7 o'clock tomorrow morning when I'm speaking with Michael Kirby on that topic. It's the Sydney University event at the Swiss Hotel in Market Street. Anyhow, you'll find it on the internet if you want to look. But they had this interesting relationship. I also wrote a piece which was in the Financial Review on the 20th of May, quite a long piece about the relationship between Roddy's Folly and Kirby's cartoons. Because, I mean, on the one hand, they were known, they were thought to hate each other, quite public. You know, the public perception was that they were at each other's throats. On the other hand, they were exchanging the, you know, teasing each other and exchanging these funny cartoons, and there was a sense in which they clearly enjoyed each other's company. And so I think an interesting question: what was their relationship? Because I don't think they're friends.
They were sworn enemies, absolutely sworn enemies, because Roddy hated him because of his sexual matters. He actually was the very strong Catholic, as you've been saying. But Roddy absolutely hated Kirby's guts and the letter writing and so forth. He publicly denounced him at a Bar Association meeting one evening. It was a shameful thing to see it happen. But that's the view that he had of Kirby. He absolutely despised him.
Now, Philip was on the district court, right?
Yes.
Right, so here's a former judge speaking about another former judge, referring to another former judge.
I mean, there was clearly a side of Roddy that... Yeah, I mean, that was the public perception, I don't deny that. There was, however... and something else that has to be said, before they sat together, I think their relationship was quite different. They, you know, he had no time for Kirby at all. And it seems that when they sat together for those years between 89, when he came to the court, and I think 96, when Kirby went to the High Court, it seems they were both surprised that they got on as well as they did. And I mean, I'm not challenging what you say you heard, but if you look in Portraits on Yellow Paper, he concludes his portrait of Michael Kirby by saying something, you know, about what a nice man he is, and that I have personally benefited from his kindness. So, I mean, this is the odd thing. In one sense, I think they could not. This is why I say they weren't friends, because I don't think they could. In my sense of what it is to be a friend, you've got to be able to accept the other person for who he is.
You're and able to communicate.
I don't think they could do that.
No,
but in another sense, I think they did share this visual humour, and that's what's interesting about these cartoons, is that it shows that you can fundamentally not be able to accept another person, and yet you can also find that you can take pleasure in one another, you know, when you've got this shared sense of humour, and I think that was it surprised both of them that this happened.
So what did Kirby say about Ma when you interviewed Kirby?
Well, I mean, Kirby, I think, agrees with my assessment. He said as much to me after he'd read it, that they couldn't see, I mean, they couldn't accept one another. He says, you know, our experiences in life were too different, our religions, our attitude to the law, our attitude to society, to everything was so different. And yet they found that there was a sense in which they could... they enjoyed each other's company. I mean, and it came down to, you know, the value of the humour, and particularly, as I say, the visual humour, and that it surprised both of them that they did become very friendly. It was said to me that until Cripps came to the court, an observer said that he thought he got on better with Kirby than any of the other judges at that time, just before Cripps came. So there seems to have been a real warmth that they could see the good in one another despite their fundamental differences.
Have I missed anyone? So we've got about 5 minutes. So tell me finally about the way you wrote the book, because it's a very substantial book. I mean, you're a pretty busy guy, and you've written a very substantial book among everything else, and you've spoken to a lot of people who knew Ma, and you've also spoken to Ma. So just tell us about your relationship with Ma and the writing of the book. I mean, to what extent was he involved? He gave you interviews, but...
Well, he didn't exactly give me interviews. I mean, I'd known him for a long time, of course, and I'd had personal conversations with him. There were one or two So very specific points that I asked him about. On the whole, I didn't interview him for the book. The book is not the product of interviews with the subject. I footnote where I've got things from, but there's very few things where it's quoting things that he said to me. This was for two reasons. One is because you find if you ask him, if you assert something that he knows is not the case, but it amuses him, he won't correct you. So you say something to him and he'll just go along with it, even though he knows it's not true, and then you assume that because he must think this is correct, you know, otherwise, I mean, a normal person, if you're interviewing about his life and you say something that's inaccurate, he would say, no, that's not the case, this was the case. But it amused him to let things go. So you see, he was not a particularly reliable source in that respect, and so there was my sense that it was better not to do that. The other thing, sadly, that I saw is by the end, you know, he was so dispirited. Whatever you talk to him about, he was very negative. And I had this. I asked him about Chesterton, and he was very negative about Chesterton. Now, Chesterton had been very important, and there's things earlier on where he'd written about that. I mean, one possibility is he just changed his mind about Chesterton, but what you could see is this was just the weariness of life, that whatever you asked him, he was just terribly weary about everything. So I realised if I ask him, I'm going to get this comment, this negative comment, this weary comment, and then I'll be obliged to take account of it. And so then the whole book is going to be coloured by the weariness of those last 6 or 12 months. So that was the other reason that if I had evidence from earlier on, I thought it was better to rely on that.
Many thanks. Take a seat.
May I just... Oh, yeah. Well, okay. Did you ever come to the conclusion that maybe that change in the spirit of Roddy in any way aligned itself with the death of Peggy, his wife?
Just a quick response about the death.
Yeah, he was very shaken by that, and I write quite a bit about that. But I must say, I met him after she'd been dead for about 7 years, and I saw a certain Roddy who still had spirit, and you saw in the last 12 months, last 6 months especially, this had just gone, you know, that this was really a reaction to that last period. Yeah.
Okay, take a seat. I'll be very brief. Janet Grundy's got some copies of Roddy's Folly. I'm very pleased that Damien Freeman chose to write this biography, and I'm very pleased that Anthony Capello, who's a small publisher out of Melbourne, chose to publish it. It's a fine publication, some lovely photographs, and well produced, and a very important contribution, and a very open assessment of an important figure in the Australian legal fraternity, and I think very fair. The author's obviously written the way that good biographies, I think, should be written. It's critical but sympathetic, which is really, I think, what you have to do for this kind of controversial figure. So congratulations for one who's been so successful at your age. No doubt you'll be writing other things, and we'd love to have you back sometime in the future, but for tonight, well done, and thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.